Well, after listening to the first three talks, I feel like mine's a bit of an outlier and could be subtitled, How to Do a Wetland Restoration Without Considering Anything About the Soil. So I want to talk to you today about a project that I've been working on with my colleague, Dr. Marshall Eames, for the past 15 years and a whole bunch of undergraduate students in the Department of Environmental Science and Studies at DePaul. And the genesis of this project was quite interesting. Back in 1995, I was relatively new to Chicago. I had a conversation with this gentleman, David Ramsey, and David worked for a not-for-profit called the Friends of the Chicago River. And he was telling me about a project that the Friends and several other organizations, federal, state, local agencies and municipalities were going to be launching. It was a wetland restoration. They were restoring farmland back to wetland in a northern suburb of Chicago. And as you can see from the thought bubble, he was just effusive about this. He said, boy, this is just going to be the greatest thing. And so the dialogue went like this. Well, gee, David, how do you know all of this? And he looked at me and it's like, well, because, Jim, that's what wetlands do. And I said, well, the science is settled then. And this is one of the things that really kind of bothers me, that people who tend to look at wetland restoration as some sort of green infrastructure, ecological panacea, that if you put them in, they're going to have all of these wonderful benefits and ecosystem services. And the fact is they don't. But the good news is I kept on pestering him with questions, and 2 weeks later he called me and said that his organization would give me $10,000 to start a water quality monitoring study. So the theme of my talk is going to really be around the need for long-term monitoring. And in this part of the United States, these types of projects don't tend to include long-term monitoring. The rationale, again, as I mentioned, was the need to do monitoring of water quality functions. But then I posed the question, why monitoring or why not monitoring? And one of the drivers of this study was a 1998 report from the Chicago Metro Office of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They went to the Chicago District of the Army Corps and they pulled the 404 permits and they looked at the design specs for these mitigation sites, and they looked at the planting lists, and then they went out in the field and they surveyed them. And this is what they reported, among other things. 52% had excessive or unplanned open water, 9% had insufficient hydrology, 4% had inappropriate substrates, including created wetlands that were built on sandy loam and loamy sand textures, and lo and behold, they held no water and all the plants had died. So, the objectives of our study then have been to compute hydrologic budgets and residence times, nutrient and sediment mass balances, retention efficiencies, assessing spatial and seasonal variations in water quality during actually both dry and wet weather events, and to assess the role of created and restored wetlands as sort of watershed management green infrastructure strategies. Prairie Wolf Slough is located 45 kilometers north of the Chicago Loop. It is owned and managed by the Lake County Forest Preserve District. It drains 98 hectares into the Middle Fork of the North Branch of the Chicago River. So it's just west of the golf course, Doug, where you were. The total area is 14 hectares. 10 hectares were converted from farmland into wetland. 4 hectares were left as woodland. 61,000 plugs were hand-planted by volunteers, which you see here in the photo. The major community types are savanna, prairie, and marsh, and these areas consist of deep, poorly drained hydric soils that are formed in loess and till parent materials. This is just an air photo showing Prairie Wolf Slough. To the north is Half Day Road. We have a major shopping center right here called Bannockburn Green. It's a tremendous amount of impervious surface that is funneling stormwater into a conveyance system that takes it into this wet bottom retention pond through two inverts, RPE and RPW. From there, it flows through an invert into a swale, where it then joins up at a confluence with another swale that drains a dry bottom detention pond through this sort of industrial office complex to the south here. The water flows along the south through the swale, through the woodland, and then we enter into the wet prairie and then into an open water palustrine emergent marsh, where it then flows out a drain pipe that connects to an agri-drain, and then from the agri-drain it goes underneath this walking path and into the Middle Fork. Since we began this study, we've been doing synoptic sampling, including weekly sampling from 2008 to 2010 at the sites in yellow. Most recently, we've begun a atmospheric deposition study, so we've got dust sampling sites. We also have pore water samplers. A little bit about the analysis. We're making a typical sort of in situ measurements of physical chemical parameters, flow measurements at our inlet site. We have a 90 degree cast aluminum V-notched weir at the outlet. We have a suppressed rectangular weir that sits inside of the agri-drain. We started measuring flow with ISCO bubbler flow meters, but I got sick and tired of the mice chewing up the line, so a couple years ago I switched over to the hobo level loggers, and they work great. When we started, we had a whole screen of analytes because I contracted with the Lake County Health Department lab. But for the last 10 years or so, I've been focusing primarily on phosphorus, and that becomes part of the rest of the story in my talk today. We've made seepage meter measurements. We're currently measuring pore water flux, dust deposits, and a colleague, Beth Lawrence, in my department is currently measuring greenhouse gas emission. So, in the beginning, we just kind of took a shotgun approach to our analysis. We did a broad spectrum of analyses, and we were mainly only interested in what was coming in, so at that inlet site right by the detention pond, and then at the outlet in the agri-drain. And for the most part, you can see that, you know, most of these analytes, the properties are remaining the same, or the values are remaining the same. You can even see there's been a reduction in nitrate and sulfate. So what became problematic for us was the phosphorus. We saw increases in phosphorus from inlet to outlet, and it was about this time that we decided that we needed to have a sampling station in the center of the marsh. So this generated a whole new set of research questions that we call kind of the great phosphorus question. Here is kind of a historical column graph looking at mean bulk water SRP and TP concentrations. And what I want to direct your attention to is look at the concentrations in the retention pond and compare those to the inlet. And you can clearly see that the retention pond is functioning as one might expect. It's filtering out sediment, organic material, and any particulate-bound phosphorus is probably going with it. So if you look at the outlet in the marsh, particularly the TP, you see that they are both above, the mean values are above the 1.0 ppm threshold that the EPA sets as being required, I guess, for eutrophication. So what we have here is internal phosphorus sourcing. Most of this phosphorus export is occurring when you have anoxic conditions. You get a shift in the redox potential of iron oxides, and you get a release of orthophosphate into the water column. And then this is a very flashy system because of the discharge and the runoff from these impervious surfaces in the watershed that feeds into this. And so this stuff just gets flushed from the system. In 2003, we did a mass balance and trap efficiency study. You can see that there was a 37% reduction in surface flow from the inlet to the outlet, as well as a two-thirds reduction in nitrate. But again, the phosphorus situation wasn't so good. And so this is a leaky wetland that is a point source of phosphorus into the Chicago River. So then we began to ask the questions, okay, so what are some potential different avenues of phosphorus coming into this palustrine emergent marsh? And our first study was done by a former student, Keegan Delaney. Keegan went out and collected standing crop of typha and dried it and then put it into a series of 12 10-gallon aquaria, filled it with marsh water, and then put in some immersion heaters. And he had three treatments, 4, 21, and 26 degrees, 27 degrees Celsius. And what he found, not surprisingly, was that the rate of decomposition was very much controlled by temperature. So this bench scale study showed that the release of SRP was very rapid, particularly at temperatures above 20 degrees C. And in as little as 21 days, the total release was as much as 250 milligrams of phosphorus per kilogram wet weight of biomass. So we feel very confident that this biomass is a significant contributor of phosphorus into the system. This raises a management issue because in that water control structure, that pipe often fills up with biomass and muck, and the water temperatures in there we've measured in excess of 95 degrees in the middle of the summer. It's as if we're brewing a huge container of compost tea. That's a management issue. I won't get into that. We summarized this in a special issue of Restoration Ecology in 2008, which was devoted to the theme of soil ecological knowledge. Then we began to wonder about pore water. And so we built these diffusion samplers, and my student, Tim Mazurek, lovingly calls these the pore water flux capacitors. And if you're interested in knowing the construction of those, I'll be happy to tell you after the break. But essentially, we put two of these in a typha fringe, two in the open water, and buried them to about 35 centimeters. And then we extract the pore water from each chamber using a lure lock and a 60-mil syringe. And here are the results, sort of the mean pore water SRP concentration. We see a definite upward flux from the bottommost chamber, which is in mineral soil, up to the top chamber, which is in this kind of senescing biomass, mucky sediment, and then on into the water column. So it looks like this could be an additional significant pathway of phosphorus into the water column. We also became interested in how much phosphorus is actually stored in the standing crop. So again, as part of Tim's senior thesis, he collected lots of standing crop of the three major species out here, soft stem and river bulrush, as well as cattail. He dried them, separated the plant parts, and digested them, and then analyzed them for total phosphorus. And as you can see, there are some significant differences here between these species. And the upshot of this is that the amount of phosphorus that is actually stored in these plants becomes sort of a theoretical upper limit of phosphorus loading into the marsh. Okay, so 2 years ago, we did another hydraulic residence time study. You know, as the wetland has matured over time, has there been a change in hydraulic residence time? One might expect that. So we use a lithium tracer. So we poured in a slug of lithium tracer at that inlet site right downstream from the V-notched weir. And then we program our ISCO samplers at the outlet to collect samples roughly every 4 hours. And what you can see here is we had a slug of lithium that arrived at about 20 or 12 hours after initiation, and this followed a almost 1-inch rainfall. So we get this first flush of lithium. But you'll notice, if you look at the flow curve on here, that's still rising. And it doesn't peak until about 27 hours after initiation of this, and that corresponds to about 20 liters per second of flow. It also conforms to a secondary peak of lithium. And you can see the SRP curve just continues to rise. And we probably did not program this long enough to capture any kind of descending limb of the flow or perhaps the SRP. So hydraulic residence time is something, if you're doing wetland restoration, it's very, very important to monitor. The key word here is monitor. If we look at it on a flow-weighted basis, we look at the masses, I want to just direct your attention to how much phosphorus is coming in versus how much phosphorus is leaving. We've got 23 times more leaving than is coming in during this four-day period. So again, shunting a lot of phosphorus into the river. We looked at flow and rainfall for 2013. And again, look at the inlet mean flow versus the outlet mean flow. Tremendous difference. And keep in mind that during this time, we were kind of encased in the polar vortex. We had a huge amount of snowpack in the wetland, and it slowly melted. And if you look at this kind of curve here, this line, okay, there we go. You can see it's rising, rising, rising over about a 2.5 month period. Then look at this, whump, it just drops. And we know why. We've got flow bypass on the south. Again, this is a management issue. So about 10 years ago, the Lake County Forest Preserve District kind of got tired of having the wetland flood on the south end over its walking path. And so we came out one day and we saw that they had dug a trench and they put in a pipe with this invert. And, you know, the thing that's bothersome, well, let me add that when I saw this, I immediately drove to the local Target and bought a rubber ball and shoved it in there. And I came out the next week and they had taken the rubber ball out and it was all shredded up and they left it right here as if it was some kind of sign. So then I went down to the True Value and I bought two bags of sacrete and I shoved it in there. And would you believe the next week I came out, they had pulled the sacrete out, it was all chunk. I felt like it was a sign from like the Forest Preserve Mafia. So I finally just waved the white flag and said, I'm never going to beat these folks, so I just have to live with it. But in all seriousness, the issue here is if the goal is to increase residence time so that you are giving the microbes enough time to do their thing with nutrient transformations, is this really a good management practice? I understand that it's expedient and it's cost effective, but I think there are other things that could have been done. My student Cassie Shaw is doing a dust deposition study for her senior thesis. She built these samplers. We ordered 2,000 marbles from a game company online. That was interesting. And she put them in mesh bags, and she goes out each week, and she collects these. You can see these kind of clear plastic bottles, and then boils them down, and we're analyzing those for TP. And you can see there's quite a bit of variability here. It's a small sample size to date, but there are some differences. And the two tall bars represent collections that were made immediately after storms that were in excess of a tenth of an inch. But if we do a quickie back of the napkin calculation, we can see that there's an average wet loading rate of about 2 kilograms per hectare per year, and that would translate into a yearly loading of about 23 kilograms. So who knows? There could be significant inputs of phosphorus via dust deposition. There are some caveats about this. You know, the canopy of cattails is pretty extensive, and they form an intermediate surface on which the dust can collect, and then it can actually enter the marsh by canopy drip or stem flow. Well, what about the soil? On the east side of the Chicago River, there is an unrestored site. It, too, was farmed, but it was not restored to wetland. That's kind of our analog site. On the west side, up around where that mesic prairie is, we took transects and collected samples for phosphorus analysis. And one of the things we noticed is in the top 30 centimeters, we have a significantly less SRP than we do in the top 30 centimeters on the east side. Now, I don't have any nutrient management records for this site because it was all rental. But in talking to a soil scientist, a soil fertility specialist in the neighboring county, McHenry County, he claims that in this area, up until World War II, farmers were using rock phosphorus. And he and I are beginning to wonder, is this some kind of fertilizer legacy whereby some of this phosphorus is being solubilized, transported by shallow groundwater down into the marsh? Who knows? My student, Katie Rico, did a sedimentation study. She set out sedimentation samplers at three sites. This is an outline of the open water marsh. The marsh entrance is really the place where that swale carries water into the marsh, and she found very high phosphorus concentrations down there. And there could be a couple of reasons. One might be that there's a lot of a pretty thick stand of typha, so a lot of that microbial decomposition of the biomass. We also see sediment trapped around the base of the typha, particularly during drawdown periods. And so it could be that some of the phosphorus has settled out on the sediment. And the soils down here are also very high in iron oxide. So perhaps some of that phosphorus that is bound to the iron oxide is being released, or maybe it's being tied up. But again, you can see a lot of spatial and temporal variability in sediment loadings. There's no stippled bar in the marsh center because the collector broke off and floated away. And about 2 months later, we found it all chewed up in a muskrat lodge. So some of the implications here are this. When I first started working on this project, it was absolutely unheard of for consultants in this area who were doing wetlands project to include soil scientists at the table, where they are often viewed, if they even hired a soil scientist, they were often just used more as technical grunts. We have and we deserve to be at the table for designing these restorations. Again, they did no preliminary soil testing on this site. Who knows what they would have done if they had, how that design might have changed had they had done that. So as you can see here, the most important aspect, I think, of this is we have to do long-term post-restoration, post-construction monitoring. But that is typically not built into these mitigation plans. My colleague, Christy Klimas, and some of her students have recently begun a study of ecosystem services out here. They're quantifying runoff reductions, looking at carbon storage and recreational value. And I'll just share a little bit of the data that Christy and her gang have turned up. They came out into the forest part and they did some transects and made a bunch of biophysical measurements, DBH. They converted those into biomass, and they have since converted those into carbon storage. And they have found that there's about 1,300 metric tons of CO2 equivalent that's being stored in this forest stand at a price of $20, which, according to Christy, is kind of the going value for these kinds of studies. That would be worth about $26,000 for the standing carbon. Across the road is a subdivision. And I posed the question to her, what if instead of the wetland on this site, we had actually put in a subdivision of about the same size? And so what she's going to do is she's going to do a comparative study in that subdivision for carbon storage. And they're going to use this program INVEST, which is part of the Natural Capital Project at Stanford, to compare these two scenarios. And they're also installing dendrometer bands on these trees to look at biomass accumulation over time. They're also going to be looking at stormwater runoff, looking at calculating the value of avoided stormwater runoff into the combined sewer system, that is across the street in the subdivision. From the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District of Greater Chicago, they'll get estimates of treatment costs per cubic feet. We know that runoff from Prairie Wolf is going into the river, it's high in phosphorus, and it's leading to, not potential eutrophication, it is leading to actual eutrophication in the river downstream. So Christy and her students will look at eutrophication potential of the outflow, and they'll compare that to the cost of treating the runoff from the subdivision. So these are just some of the warriors, students who have worked with me. I have too many students to list, and thanks to these organizations for their support, financial and otherwise. Thanks.